This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. A lot of World War I music hung around for generations in piano benches in central Illinois. And Bloomington Normal's Dale Evans collects it.
There was about 4,000 titles written during World War I. So, you know, you've got a market for those. But the Victrola was the way, that's how you heard mass music, you know.
GLT's Laura Kennedy talks with Evans and brings you Goodbye Broadway, Hello France, and other songs of the Great War. It's been a year since President Trump won the election. ISU scholars Eric Rankin and Tom McClure assess that time and compare and contrast with past presidential administrations. And find out how local authors make a living. Ryan Denham has that story. All of that and a GLT News update on the way. It's November 9th, 2017. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. President Trump's approval rating hit a record seven-decade low this week when compared with numbers of other presidents, according to a Washington Post ABC News poll. Expectations for Trump's presidency have also dropped significantly since before he took office. He's also still in search of a major legislative win with Congress. This week marks a year since Donald Trump was elected president. During the campaign, beginning with the conventions, we checked in with ISU political scientists Eric Rankin and Tom McClure to talk about the unconventional campaign. They're back to talk about the unconventional presidency of Donald Trump. Eric and Tom, thanks for being on Sound Ideas. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Mike.
Our pleasure.
Tell me how modern-day presidents' first 10 to 12 months have been judged in the past. What are the metrics? What's important? And how is President Trump stacking up?
Yeah, great question. I mean, traditionally, right, this is always known as the honeymoon period, right? You take that first, your traditional 100 days or even into the first year, and a lot of presidents realize that their popularity is usually at the highest at this point in time. Donald Trump, his was not. He did not come in with a resounding majority of Americans. I mean, this is still a guy that lost the popular vote, but and ekes by in the Electoral College. He was a polarizing character at best. And then as he walked in, I mean, it was a series of mistakes, one right after the other. He continued not to really pull people together and continued a really divisive style of rhetoric.
And Tom, what do you think? Eric seems to think that polls are one way to compare this president to other presidents. What about other metrics?
Well, I think if you take a look at legislative accomplishments, it's been a dismal failure. There hasn't been any piece of legislation that has that has turned out in the way that Trump wanted it to turn out. The only measure that I can think of that shows that he's having a great time is the stock market. The stock market's at a record high, which is somewhat surprising because we haven't enacted a tax reform law. And as far as everything else is concerned, it seemed like it was more disruption and confusion that was being caused. So despite his efforts or lack of efforts to get things done, the country's doing well economically.
So how much credit, or if the stock market was going down, blame does the president actually get for how the stock market is performing?
He always gets the credit and the blame, but is whether or not
but it really has little effect on it, right?
That's
direct
correct.
Effect.
That's correct.
Well, or at least in this situation, I mean, we have yet to pass a Trump budget. So we have been operating under an Obama budget. If, in fact, you wanted to actually take credit, I mean, he's taking credit for a lot of the things that were started, and the trajectory was already happening under Obama. Now, this isn't anything new. Presidents have been doing this, you know, for a generation. But a lot of what we're seeing is not just because of Donald Trump, or if any.
So let's talk about legislation for a moment. Efforts to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. I think three swings at the plate on that one and a strikeout. There's still talk of repealing the individual mandate as part of the tax reform bill. Where does the blame lie for the failure of the to reform or replace Obamacare? Eric?
Yeah, that, I think that clearly it lies in a, I don't know if you want to blame the Republicans. Yes, they're in some ways it is their fault. They're not able to keep their disparate bodies together. But at the same time, it's been the grassroots effort of the left and the Democrats that have mounted a very strong opposition that have forced a lot of mainstream, more establishment Republicans, especially Republicans that are elected in blue districts, knowing that if they go and vote for this, they're going to get hammered in the next election.
And ISU political scientist Tom McClure, your thoughts?
Well, the big problem is that there's not a majority to support any particular kind of health program. There are Democrats who would love to see a single-payer system, but there's not a majority who are willing to do that. On the Republican side, you've got some moderate Republicans who are willing to give Obamacare a chance in trying to fix the problems there, but you've got people who are deficit hawks, who are conservatives, who do not want to pass that. So right now, we've got these three different factions, and I don't see anything being resolved.
Let's talk about deficit hawks and the tax reform bill. Do you think the tax reform bill will actually move through the process and end up on the president's desk, Tom McClure?
I wish I knew the answer to that question. Some days I think that it will, and some days I think that it won't. I think something is going to be enacted. I don't know whether it's going to look very much like what's being proposed right now, but I think that there is going to be some sort of tax reform. And it may be leading to the defeat of incumbents come November, because there definitely will be losers the way that it's being proposed right now.
Losers in the middle class, as you look further out in this tax plan, as I understand it, Eric.
Big time, and not only that. I mean, you find that in the Senate and the House, there are no way, shape, or form are they on the same page with one another. And if they want to pass any type of legislation, they're going to have to do something together. I think I saw even before I came in here, just moments before I sat down, that the Senate had talked about their capital. It was either one of their reforms, that they were going to pause it until 2019. And that was under the Senate plan, which would, you've heard Trump saying, we need to lower the corporate tax rate. That's where it was at. We need to lower the corporate tax rate immediately. And if the Senate plan is to pause it until 2019, now you have the Senate that's out of step with the president, that's out of step with the House. And all it shows is a Republican Party, from an electoral standpoint, that is just in a state of disarray.
So legislative victories is one way to judge President Trump against other presidents. What about foreign policy? Any wins there? Is it all overshadowed by North Korea? Tom?
Okay, I think that this week has been a great week for Trump as far as foreign policy goes. He's acting presidential, which is very interesting. I think that it's the thing he needs to do.
How low is the bar, Tom?
Right.
Well, but I think that he's doing what he needs to do when he's out there, and I think that that's very positive. I think people were expecting him to have the same kind of rhetoric against China that we heard during the campaign, and he's very respectful. So I think that he's moving in the right direction.
Eric Rankin, ISU political scientist.
I think your point was great. I mean, how low is the bar set? Now we're to the point where as long as Trump doesn't say something that's just asinine, then we say, all right, well, he did an okay job. I mean, he stuck to a speech and he stayed with it. Though watching that speech, it was just really uncomfortable seeing him sit down and lecture a group of South Koreans on what they lost the last time that there was a military conflict in Korea. I'm like, I'm pretty sure
they know.
They're pretty well aware. It was weird. But, and again, no matter how strong of a showing he had or lack of failure at his speech, it was completely lost in the story of the Democrats' electoral victories.
So I think I know where Eric Rankin stands on Trump's foreign policy victories. Tom, a general statement here about how he's doing in terms of foreign policy?
Well,
this recent trip aside, maybe?
Okay, not talking about this recent trip. I don't know that he's really done anything very significant about foreign policy one way or the other. At the very beginning of his presidency, when he made the decision to bomb Syria, that was a bold statement. It seemed to be a measured statement. It seemed to be something that was on the right track, if you believe that kind of action is appropriate. And the military did. But other than that, I don't know whether we've really seen anything other than this childish game that he's been playing with North Korea. I think that certainly has been a failure. But thank goodness it hasn't escalated to the point of actual attacks.
You know, a flippant remark here. I've been sleeping relatively well the last few days because I know that there probably won't be a first strike in Asia while Trump is there.
Yeah.
Again, a flippant remark. So, immigration. If real legislative reform may be elusive, strong rhetoric that immigrants aren't welcome may be the reason border crossings are down. Can this president be effective with any real change with just his words, just his tweets? Tom?
Well, I don't think that that's the only thing that he's done in terms of immigration, because of his rescission of the executive order that Obama had, I think, is definitely action. And I think that that's something that I'm still expecting it's going to prompt Congress to do something. But as the days go on, I'm becoming less and less optimistic about that. I think the tweets are silly. I don't understand why he wants to continue to be in campaign mode with the tweets, but that's just his quirk, I guess.
Eric Rankin.
And who at Twitter thought it was okay to expand out to 240 characters under his presidency? I don't know. But what I will say is that I do think that from the immigration standpoint, I mean, this may be delivering another notch in the Democrats' arsenal, because it's quite possible that the Dems could shut down the government over DACA. And that, as long as they're the party that is seen to be taking care of immigrants or being the open and inclusive party, it is stoking the rhetoric of their supporters, and I think it's furthering it's keeping that 30, 35, 37%, whatever the base is, that will never leave Trump. It's keeping them angry, and it's keeping the other groups are starting to grow.
Will we see a border wall?
We will never see a border wall, and specifically because we will never pay for the cost of it. There is not a single Republican at the end of the day that is going to be willing to foot that bill for that wall. There's just no – you can't call yourself a conservative and spend the insane amount of money that it would cost to do what it is he suggests.
We've seen examples of possible border walls erected near the border. Tom, do you agree with Eric that we won't see a border wall?
I agree with Eric.
What should we make of the inter-administration squabbles with his own Secretary of State, or most notably his Attorney General? Tom, what do you think of that? Is that Donald Trump not understanding or not caring what this looks like, or what effect it might have on his own presidency?
I think it's classic Donald Trump. I think that that's one of the ways that he's been able to be successful. I think that he's very manipulative. He used that quality in the private sector to get his way, and I think he's just using the same techniques. Washington is not used to seeing the chief executive officer to belittle his top aides in public like this, but that's Donald Trump. And for whatever it's worth, many of them continue to stay on. Sessions, I mean, it's just amazing to me. I've fired clients before. I'm surprised that Sessions isn't firing his client.
Hmm. And so, Eric, do you think this is a strategy of Donald Trump's?
If it is, it's a terrible strategy. I mean, this guy has burned out more people in his own administration. If you look at pictures from Inauguration Day and the people that he surrounded himself with, they are all but gone now. Almost everybody that was close to him has found an exit or has been reshuffled into another location. He is burning out people left and right. And I think in some respects, I mean, why would you want to work for somebody? I mean, he was all but supporting, we'll use a great example, all but supporting a guy like Gillespie the night before. And then, you know, the treadmarks aren't even fresh on Gillespie's face before Trump turns on him on Twitter.
We're talking about the gubernatorial election in Virginia. Yeah.
There's no loyalty to him. You must be loyal to Donald, but he does not have to be loyal to you.
So Steve Bannon says the strategy that Gillespie employed in Virginia was Donald Trump's plan light, right? They didn't bring Trump in. Trump and Gillespie didn't share a stage. So that gave Donald Trump a way to distance himself.
Sure.
Does that matter, Eric?
No, I mean, no, because Gillespie couldn't run with Trump because he's at least intelligent enough to read polling reports. You can't run with a guy that is divisive in a state that has been, in a lot of respects, at least in the gubernatorial standpoint, has been blue. While at the same time, you can't run away from him because you're a Republican and you have to have him at your back. It was I don't want to call it a no-win situation for Gillespie, but he was, I mean, to try and pin Gillespie as not being part of the establishment is absolutely laughable. This guy has been establishment Republican Party for the better part of the last four decades.
He was the RNC chairman,
right,
wasn't he, at one point?
Right.
Well, let's jump ahead to the election results from Tuesday. Do you think based on the limited election results on Tuesday, we could see a House controlled by Democrats. Is that too much of a jump at this point?
I absolutely don't think it's too much of a jump. I mean, it really does depend on, A, how many Republicans, and we're starting to see the effect of that now, how many of them are going to just decide, I don't want to run, and how many of those are going to be in areas that are competitive. You're seeing a lot of those competitive districts get good, solid candidates. I mean, candidates are coming out of the woodwork for the Democratic Party now. It used to be a problem for the Democrats to field people to run for offices. I mean, you even take this area as an example. People are coming out left and right to run.
And Tom, what do you think the effect of turnout and maybe how the districts are drawn will affect the 2018 midterm elections?
Well, I think the key is motivation. Trump's people are clearly motivated voters, and you can expect that they're going to be there. I think Eric's right. If you have some quality Democratic candidates that can motivate people to come out, then the Democrats can make a big change. But that was the problem, I think, that took place for the Democrats in the presidential election. Mm-hmm. The Democrats were not as motivated to get the voters weren't as motivated to vote for their candidate than Trump supporters were.
And what do you think about issues? Some of the exit polling indicated that health care was a top issue, driving voters to the poll and driving them to vote for one candidate over another. In Maine, voters approved a Medicaid expansion under the ACA by an 18% margin. This would tell me that perhaps the Republicans' efforts to continually attack Obamacare is a bad strategy. What do you two think, Eric?
I mean, I certainly think it's a terrible strategy. If I'm a Republican right now, I don't even want to talk about health care. I want to talk about tax reform. It's a loser for them to go. And this years ago, this is one of the things that I heard a lot of Republicans talking about. What their worry was, if Obamacare ever got passed, that it would be almost impossible to get rid of it. And then I think they're correct. People have gotten comfortable with it. They believe that, and we just saw record enrollments into Obamacare. I think that they're, this last month, I think that it's all blown back up in their face. People are scared about healthcare costs. They're seeing their healthcare costs rise at a time when their wages are staying stagnant. They're scared to death. People are not able to retire at times that they'd like to. And so healthcare is something that they need and they want.
And Tom, I just want to make sure I understand what you said. Is there a chance that the Democrats could flip the House in 2018? What do you think?
I don't think it's very likely.
Not very likely.
No.
But not outside the realm of possibilities.
Well, in politics, nothing's outside the realm of possibility, but I don't think it's likely.
All right. Well, that's Eric Rankin, that's Tom McClure. Also in the studio is ISU political scientist Eric Rankin. We've been talking to them since this summer. They're back to talk about President Trump's 10 months in office so far. He was elected a year ago yesterday. Let's talk about the Supreme Court and judicial appointments. People generally focus on the Supreme Court, but the next justice might come from one of the federal appointments to the bench. That's something that Trump has been busy doing, is appointing people to the federal bench. Is that a long-lasting legacy of President Trump, even in his first 10 months? Tom?
Absolutely. I think that the elevation of Justice Gorsuch to the court is key to keeping essentially a conservative court in power. He's a young man. He's going to be in the court for a long time. I think it will be very important. Now, the irony of it is, when we get into issues of presidential power concerning President Trump, I don't think that his candidate is necessarily going to be supportive of him because he's got a very independent streak. But I think that he will have a lasting impact.
And Eric Rankin, what do you think of judicial appointments and Neil Gorsuch?
Yep.
A position, let me point out, I think I need to point this out, that should have been Merrick Garland should have probably gotten a hearing.
He did not. At the very least.
Neil Gorsuch was appointed as the next Supreme Court justice and confirmed, Eric.
Certainly. Yeah. I mean, if I'm going to say not in agreement with, that I think that he was a great candidate, but Neil Gorsuch is absolutely qualified for the job. I don't agree with him politically in any way, shape, or form, but this might be one of those places where when someone asks me what has Trump done in his year, here's the spot where I'd say Trump got something something done. He was able to pick a person that pretty much the right was in lockstep and they were all happy with. He was a person that sailed for the most part through a confirmation hearing. I agree with Tom wholeheartedly. I mean, Tom would know a lot more than I would, obviously, in this situation. But my understanding of Neil Gorsuch is he's a guy that is no fan of the administrative state and is certainly not a person that, I mean, you see expansions of executive power, and this might be a Supreme Court member that would rule against what his appointer would have.
I want to point something out about him, too. People say he's conservative in all respects. I don't think that he necessarily is. When you take a look at some of his lower court decisions on Fourth Amendment issues, he tends to be more towards the rights of the accused on Fourth Amendment issues, whereas Merrick Garland, former U.S. attorney, a prosecutor, is much more in favor of the state. So in some respects, he may be more liberal than conservative. Now, obviously, when you deal with the size of government and federalism, he's more conservative than Garland.
But parts of President Trump's travel ban were allowed by the Supreme Court, and that probably would not have happened without Neil Gorsuch.
Probably would have been a deadlock otherwise.
Yeah. Have we become numb to the unrelenting shocks, as Michelle Goldberg wrote in the New York Times this week? What now passes for ordinary, she writes, would have once been inconceivable. How has this country changed? Eric Rankin?
And this is probably my biggest fear. So, I mean, walking into class, I mean, teaching courses on American government and U.S. presidency, I oftentimes would have students that we would begin with, did you hear what Trump said today? Because it's so constant and it happens all the time, the questions aren't asked anymore because it's just become routine. It's part of our day. It's like watching a commercial. You expect it. I learn nothing for the most part. And that's a big fear that I have, because I think that energizes a certain group of people, while at the same time, it turns another group of people off. They think, politics is terrible. It's divisive. They use this terrible rhetoric and this terrible language, and it drives people away. And that's my biggest fear, is that people are going to, this is going to create more apathy rather than true excitement.
And Tom McClure?
I'm very concerned about what's happening culturally, and it's not necessarily because of what Trump supporters are doing. I think it's the reaction to Trump. I think that you see people on both extremes who are completely intolerant of beliefs. They will not accept even someone talking about something that's opposite to what they believe. And I think that's very harmful. I think that we need to develop a greater civility so that we can disagree, but we can do it in a respectful manner and allow people to talk. I find it very frightening that there have been college campuses where they have not allowed certain speakers because the unruly crowd won't let that happen. I think that's a big problem.
Is it because of the unruly crowd or the hate speech, what some people would call hate speech, that those speakers might espouse?
Well, I heard a young man say one time, I'm not intolerant except for people who are intolerant. And I think that that's what happens. Everyone thinks that they're right and they've got all the answers. And I think that is a big problem.
But at the same time, we also see a change even in Congress with, you know, we're talking about a tax reform bill that will affect at least 100% of our economy. And yet not a single hearing has been held. There's been next to zero discussion in the House of Representatives about it. That's not how the last time, I think, if I'm not mistaken.
Has the CBO weighed in?
The CBO has yet to weigh in, and that'll actually change a ton of things. The interesting part, I think, when in 1986, which is the last time when Reagan was able to pass through tax reforms, I think there were over 40 hearings that happened in the House of Representatives about this, where people that were experts could come in and testify and talk to committee members that were both Democrats and Republicans. But that's not happening. We're just shoving things down each other's throat, and you can't do anything even remotely on a bipartisan basis if you know you have no say whatsoever.
I mentioned his approval and disapproval numbers. The ABC Washington Post poll released Monday shows 59% disapprove of Trump's handling of the presidency. That's the worst of any president at this point since modern polling began. Only 37% approve of his performance in office. Will anything erode that 37% number? Is that a floor? Anything to tamp down his support from his base, Tom McClure?
Well, I think that Trump has shown that you can't believe the polls. Because if you believe the polls, we'd be talking about President Clinton, wouldn't we?
Right.
Eric?
Well, I'd say that there's some truth to polls, too. So as wrong as they can be to your benefit, they can also be wrong, right? We knew that Ralph Northam was up by just a couple of eyelashes over Gillespie, and then it ended up being a 9-point spread. What that tells me is that they didn't. Those polls don't usually, they can't accurately figure out enthusiasm. Hmm. And that is, that enthusiasm was with Trump, or it was just a lack of enthusiasm for Hillary. Clinton, right. That's I still maintain that one more. But I will say that I think that in the future, it's going to be difficult. This number that we, you asked Tom the question of, can it go lower? I think it can. I think it can go. If he can't get through, even, you know, he's already now made promises of Thanksgiving plus Christmas for tax reform. If that continues to go longer, then I think you're going to see him drop even. I think you're going to see him drop.
Does his base care about tax reform? Or do they care about
I think they care about something to say that they won on, right? They like to be winners. Remember, we were going to be so sick of winning, and we don't have any wins yet, maybe with the exception of Gorsuch. So sure. I think he's not going to go anywhere below 30, but he can drop. I mean, another 7% would be catastrophic for him.
Despite a Time magazine piece this week that shows for his supporters the whole Mueller investigation is nothing more than a witch hunt, a plot by the establishment to discredit the president with any dirt they can dig up, high-level campaign workers are being indicted. Vanity Fair is reporting the West Wing is fearful of impeachment. Where do you think the Mueller investigation will go, and could it lead to impeachment by a Republican-controlled Congress? Are the Republicans to the point where they are sort of getting tired of Donald Trump? Tom McClure?
They may be tired of him, but they're not going to impeach him. It's going to hurt them more in the midterms if they go that direction. And really, the set of indictments that came down, in my view, was a good day for Donald Trump, because you've got these high-level people and didn't have anything to do with the campaign. And so that being the case for the high-level people, that makes me think they didn't have anything to link them or link Trump into it. The low-level person, you could tell that that's being done to squeeze him, and we'll see whether or not he's got any information.
Eric Rankin?
Yeah, maybe Tom and I diverge a bit here. I think this is the setup. I think this is a calm before the storm. I think that Mueller has just begun. I think we're days away from a Flynn indictment. I think we're going to probably get close to seeing his son being indicted. I don't think that the list is done there. I mean, there are probably other people like a George Papadopoulos that are out there that we just haven't even heard of yet. Now, the other question of whether or not he will be impeached, I don't believe so prior to the midterms. But if he gets past the midterms and the Republicans get shellacked and they find out that it was all because of how the public is perceiving Donald Trump, then at that point in time, they'll exercise their demon. And I think you could see something happen at that point.
So I have two more quick questions here, and we're running out of time. Trump's options as it concerns Mueller. Keep in mind, he's an unconventional president and seems to get away with actions past presidents wouldn't have considered. Will Mueller remain as special prosecutor? Either one of you, jump in.
I think if he gets rid of Mueller, that's it.
I think that if he discharges Mueller, that he will be impeached.
I agree.
And you're both professors. Quickly, assign a letter grade based on past presidents to this president so far.
I would give him an I, an incomplete.
Interesting.
Eric? I would give him a large D-. And the only reason that he passes the class is because he did get Gorsuch nominated.
All right. Eric, Tom, thanks for your time on Sound Ideas. Either one of you willing to come back in January as President Trump marks his first year in office? We can have some of this conversation again, get to some questions we haven't gotten to.
We can only dream.
Either that or President Pence. Certainly.
All right. Eric Rankin and Tom McClure are political scientists with Illinois State University and are frequent guests on Sound Ideas. Thanks for choosing 89.1 FM GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.
Support for GLT comes from Justin M. Boyd, Country Financial Representative, proud to serve you from his new office in historic downtown Bloomington. Justin offers life insurance options to protect your family and leave a lasting legacy. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. For many people, one item on their bucket list seems to be a bit more attainable than all the rest, to write their own book. Many of us have thought about writing our own book, and with the rise of self-publishing platforms, ebooks, and Amazon, it feels easier than ever to get it done. Last week at Bloomington's Public Library, GLT's Ryan Denham met some local authors who've actually done it successfully. They were featured at the library's first ever Local Authors Fair, part of National Novel Writing Month. Ryan starts with Laurie Larson from Normal, who writes inspirational romance.
I actually started my first book in 1999, and I was on a business trip in Atlanta, Georgia, and I found myself with a free weekend. And I thought, oh, you know what, I'm going to sightsee, I'm going to, you know, see the city. The first place I went was the Margaret Mitchell House, which is where Margaret Mitchell wrote about 75% of Gone with the Wind. And I went through the tour, and something just gripped me. And it took her 10 years to write it. And throughout that whole time, she never had any confidence that this would ever be a good book. And there was just something very, very inspiring about it. So when I got out of the tour, I canceled all the rest of my sightseeing. I went back to the hotel and started outlining out a book. And I wrote all weekend, and that actually turned out to be my first published book, which was called Whispers of the Heart.
And how many books have you written since?
18. So I kind of started and never stopped. It was addictive.
And did you at some point transition from doing it as an amateur basis and as a hobbyist into a professional?
Well, I've always written with a day job. So for the last 18 years, I've juggled my full-time career with my writing career. But yes, I would say that it moved from hobby status to more serious about it when I became an independent author, which is instead of using a publisher, which I used for my first five books, I basically became the publisher. I kind of opened up an imprint and I do everything. I do the writing, the editing, I hire out the formatting and the cover art, and I do the advertising. So of course it becomes much more time consuming to do all that, but also much more rewarding because I have such control over my writing business.
So Laura, you write inspirational romance, is how you put it, as your genre. Why that genre? What draws you back to that over and over again?
So I mentioned I've been writing for 18 years, and at the beginning, probably the first 11 years of that, I wrote straight contemporary romance, so no inspirational theme. And I wrote, you know, I did write some good books, but what I felt was that it wasn't really reaching the audience that I wanted to reach. And so being a woman of faith, I prayed about it. And I think God led me to writing more about love stories that also incorporated a faith journey. So most of my books incorporate the characters using prayer and Bible study in order to get the guidance from God in order to make the major decisions in their life. And once I started writing those books, I found an audience that these books really became meaningful to them, you know, and they would start to write to me and say, well, who's the next character? Because the series has six books in the series and they all kind of build on each other. So after one would come out, they'd say, well, who's next? And who, you know, who's this one going to be about? And they were much more well-received and memorable to my readers than my current contemporary romances. So I figured I better stick with a good thing.
What role does writing play in your life? How important is it?
It's important to me because I feel like in my life, especially when I was younger, like now I am an empty nester. My kids are grown. But, you know, big parts of my life were, you know, I was an employee for a company. I was a mom of kids. I was a wife of a husband. I was a church member and choir singer and all this stuff. But writing is something I do entirely for myself, you know, and it's my creative outlet. It's adds so much flavor and depth to the other activities of my life. And it just brings me pleasure because it's just for me.
Andy Zeck, comic paranormal animal author from Peoria, and I'm visiting here in Bloomington Normal to show my books in my series, Life After Life Chronicles. The first one, Zombie Turkeys. The second one, My Undead Mother-in-Law.
Describe again the genre that you work in. That was an interesting collection of of nouns.
When you're an author and there are 4 million authors on Amazon, you want a unique genre. Mine's comic paranormal animal author. So I take animals and give them paranormal qualities like super strength and super speed, like red-eyed turkeys that cannot be killed, and then I make it all funny as well as horrible.
So how long have you been writing, Andy? When was your first book published?
The first book was published almost exactly 1 year ago. Zombie Turkeys came out October 31st, 2016, and then My Undead Mother-in-Law just came out this year, August 5th.
So how did that feel, that having that first book published a year ago? What was that moment like for you?
Oh, man, that was a wonderful feeling. The very first time you hold your own printed book in your hands and know it's your baby all the way through, and having gone through dozens of editing rounds and everything else that's required even for your first book.
Can you talk a little bit about the role that writing plays in your life and why it is such an important part of your life?
I did do it as a youngster, starting in third grade, and then I wrote science fiction all through grade school, and then I wrote a comedy play in junior high school, and then a short story in high school and also in college, but then I had to make money. So I became a programmer and then a systems analyst and a project manager. And then when I retired from Caterpillar, I went back to my first love, writing. And the day after I retired, I started my novel for November in 2015 and wrote Zombie Turkeys that month.
I'm Alyssa Day. I'm actually a Normal writer. I live in Normal, and I've lived in Bloomington before Normal, and I graduated from ISU, and I never left, basically.
Well, what kind of books do you write?
I write urban fantasy, paranormal romance, but I also have a children's pen name, too. It's Melissa Davis is my children's pen, and I do like chapter books and young adults. But for the most part, I enjoy doing paranormal. I love the paranormal books.
When did you write your first book?
My first book actually was like right after I graduated from college in 1999. It took me a while to do that. The first book was like 8 year of progress. Like, it took forever. But once that one was done, then it just started coming out. Like, you've worked out the kinks on how to get all the chapters down and how to plot and how to get everything going cohesively. And once I did that, it just seemed to flow. Actually, the interesting thing is the first book that I did after that was The Land of the Shadows, which is now called Shadow Walker. That was based on my experiences in Bloomington Normal. So, like, there's the part where the factory downtown fell. That's in the book, too. Like, the people were fighting on the inside with their magic, and it knocked down the building. The cemetery across from Miller Park very much inspired that story as well, too. And ISU campus. I mean, I never come right out and say where it's taking place, but it really was very much inspired by this area. So,
what is your process for writing? Where do you physically write? Are you at home? Are you in an office? Are you out and about? How does that work?
Anywhere. Like, I take my kid to gymnastics a lot, so sometimes I'll sit down there and I'll write, or I'll put down plot ideas and things like that. I try to squeeze it in wherever I can. The armchair, the desk, McDonald's, Panera, you know, all these places are places I tend to write. Wherever I find inspiration, I write down something as quickly as I can so I don't forget it. Because I have a lifetime of ideas in my head that I can't get out. So it sometimes seems like you have voices that are like, I have to be heard, and they're fighting. Like, which one do you tell first? And so right now I'm trying to figure out, do I work on my young adult book that I have planned, or do I work on the continuation for the Revenant series? So it's a battle. They battle it out, trying to figure out who's going to make it out first.
So how many books have you written altogether, including your children's pen name?
I think I'm up to 20 right now. Writing for me is my balance. It's how I center myself. When you're a stay-at-home mom working on everything you can for the kids and running them everywhere, you have to have your me time and have to find a way to ground yourself so that you can be that everything for everybody else. You have to find, how do you be you? And this is where I get to be me. Right now, what really puts a smile on my face is my 7-year-old is writing stories. She wants to do everything that I do. She wants to be able to put stories together and come up with funny things and make people laugh. So she spent the week just putting together 10 pages of a story she's writing.
Now, do you work with a publisher? Are you self-publishing at this point? Where are you at there?
I work with a small publisher called World Castle Publishing, and I do have one that's independently published right now, which is my Shadow Walker book. But I do work with a smaller one, and because we're smaller, we are still considered independent. So I started when a friend was getting published there. I kind of put feelers in, like, oh, maybe I should try. And they were smaller, and so there was a better chance maybe of getting accepted. And I got accepted first time out. So.
That's GLT's Ryan Denham speaking with some of the writers featured at Bloomington's Public Library inaugural Local Authors Fair last weekend. The event was part of November's National Novel Writing Month. Last November, organizers say 384,000 people around the world wrote their own novels. You're listening to Sound Ideas.
Support for GLT comes from Brad Barker Honda, working with car buyers to match them with quality, reliable vehicles suited to their lifestyles and budgets. Veterans Parkway and GE Road in Bloomington or online at bradbarkerhonda.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
In 1917, when America marched off to join the fight in World War I, it marched to the rhythm of popular songs written especially to accompany a patriotic fervor. Laura Kennedy has more.
Over there, send the word over there, that the Yanks are coming, the Yanks are coming, the drums rum coming everywhere, so prepare.
When George N. Cohan wrote this rousing number, Americans were enthralled by the patriotic soundtrack that accompanied the war effort. But before America joined the war, before the sinking of the Lusitania, the nation was reluctant to join the fight over there. And that mood, too, was reflected in popular songs, like this one, I Didn't Raise My Boy to Be a Soldier.
I didn't raise my boy to be a soldier. I brought him up to be my pride and joy. Who dared to place a musket on his shoulder?
Musician Dale Evans is giving a presentation about World War I songs Saturday at the McLean County Museum of History. He has a large collection of sheet music of the era, and he says this anti-war song was popular with the pacifist movement prior to the U.S. entry into World War I. The song, in fact, was a real hit. Then, once America got into the war, it was a hit again, with a twist.
They changed the title of that to It's Time for Every Boy to Be a Soldier.
So and, you could have the
so
same
you
cadence.
You could have the same cadence, the same song, they just changed the words.
It's time for every boy to be a soldier, to put his strength and courage to the test.
How important was sheet music at this time? And we didn't have radio.
Well, this is the thing. So now this was at the point. Now, I've got sheet music from before this. I mean, like my collection starts like in the 1890s. I think a few things came together. Printing got a lot better. There were a lot more publishing houses. And the Victrola was the technology of the time. I mean, this, and a lot of people still had pianos in their houses. So you've got these piano benches with full of sheet music. And someone said there was about 4,000 titles written during World War I. So, you know, you've got a market for those. But the Victrola was the way, that's how you heard mass music, you know. And, of course, movies were silent, so you didn't have the movie musical that you had 20 years later.
Well, certainly movies had a role in influencing how people felt about the war. How could sheet music and popular song influence us and how we felt about getting involved in World War I?
Well, here again, this was, you know, this was the era of vaudeville. You know, Bloomington was a vaudeville stop and central Illinois. So, you know, you had these people coming through and singing the songs, promoting the war or promoting patriotism. And from there, you know, it traveled all over by the rails
by the fact that we're all in a theater together and we're hearing these songs being sung together, mm-hmm. Did that work us up into more of a frenzy than if we had been at home alone with a piano playing Goodbye Broadway, Hello France?
It probably did. You know, you had what we call community sings, okay? And they were wildly popular. And you would get together, and these would be some of the songs that they would sing. Also, a few of the well-known European artists, they would come over here. McLean County Historical Society has this great picture of Harry Lauder, who was one of the top English music halls.
Yeah.
Yes, and he was there, standing there at the railroad station in his kilt and his Scottish garb, and he came to promote the British war effort. It's a great moment in local history because he was known worldwide, and he, you know.
He was the Jay-Z of his time.
Exactly. Okay.
Let's talk about some of the styles of songs that were popular during World War I. And I think probably one that we can easily remember is by George M. Cohan.
Right.
Over there.
Johnny, get your gun, get your gun, get your gun. Johnny, show the Hun you're a son of a gun. Hoist the flag and let her fly. Yankee Doodle, do or die. Pack your little...
Half of the songs have the words over there in the title. There's one right
here. We'll do our share.
We'll do our share while you're over there.
Who wrote that?
Gosh, who knows? Words by Lou Brown and Al Harriman, which I don't know.
I have no idea.
I have no idea. But, you know, the words over there are very common in a lot of World War I songs. It was almost like a code, you know, that was a catchword, over there. And you'll find a pattern after a while that a lot of these songs, there, some of them are funny, and they will do a little play on words, mm-hmm. but they come back to either over there, Ma, apple pie, and the flag, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, the patriotism, you know, I'm sending my boy over there. I hope he comes back. My daddy's over there. Say a prayer for my daddy over there.
I think there was also quite a lot of Kaiser bashing going on.
Oh, yeah.
With certain songs.
I've got one title in my little collection. It's called We'll Make the Kaiser Goose Dip to a Good Old American Rag.
They'll make him dance for fair. And I'd sure like to be there when the Kaiser does a goose step to a good old American rag. They'll play a jerky and make Bill walk turkey and salute that grand old flag. He'll be wiser when he two steps to the tunes of Yankee Land. Our foxtrots too.
Well, you needed a villain. But the thing is, here again, you've got to think about the times. World War I for all. You know, if you want to simplify it, it was a family feud that got out of hand because all the royal families were related. The Tsar, the Kaiser, and King George, they were cousins. They were first cousins. So the Kaiser, he was a tyrant, but he was no Hitler. He was not a psychopath. He was a villain, but he was also a very learned person. And by the way, he spoke perfect English. He could sell insurance at State Farm if he was around nowadays. You know?
You've got a nice pile there of sheet music.
Right.
And you have one that I've always wanted to hear. Goodbye, Broadway.
Hello
France.
Goodbye, Broadway. Hello, France. 15 million strong. Goodbye, sweethearts, wives, and mothers. It won't take us long.
That had to have been hugely popular because there's so many copies of that in antique stores today.
This was another theme that we owed France for our independence, so now we're going to pay them back.
It has
Lafayette,
a real,
we are here.
It has a real sort of bon vivant kind of feel to this song, and you have this wonderful image of an American soldier shaking hands with
General Pershing and General Joffre.
And they're shaking hands across the Atlantic. But,
right.
And it also kind of goes along with that sort of like chipper sort of feel that a lot of people went into this war not knowing the horrors
naive.
That were ahead of them.
Well, see, this was the thing, we were very naive on this side of the channel. Now, remember, by the time we got over there. The war had been going on for 3 years, and you had the Battle of Verdun and the Somme where you had lost 20,000 people in one day. I think we were in it really for about a year. It took us a year to get everything together and get over there again. So
you
can't get away from that word. You start off with the reluctance of, I didn't raise my boy to be a soldier. And now it's every time for every boy to be a soldier. And there was an Irving Berlin song called Will There Be Any Home Sweet Home When It's Over, over there.
Mm-hmm.
So they got to the point, and in a funny way, you've got a song written after the war. It's called How You Gonna Keep Them
Down
on
the Farm after
they've
seen
Perry.
Right.
How you gonna keep them down on the farm after they've seen Perry? Away from Broadway, jabbing around and painting the town. How you gonna...
Dale, you brought a ukulele with you today, and I was hoping you could play a little from it and let us know. I mean, was this a very popular instrument during World War One?
It was, yes, it was, because it was just beginning its popularity. Where ukulele just became really popular was they had this international exhibit in San Francisco in 1915, the Pacific Pan American and that exhibit, an exhibit from Hawaii, and they brought the ukuleles and stuff like that, and people just went crazy over them. And so everybody wanted to have a ukulele. Of course, the banjo, the mandolin, not so much guitar at those days, but that was very popular. And the ukulele was discovered, and they found out it was easy to make, easy to play, and it fit.
And
you
it's
know,
portable.
A lot of the tone.
It's very portable.
Yeah. And you would put this in your backpack and all this. I'm saying KKKKT and stuff like that, you know.
Can you play us a little something from the era?
Okay, this is a song. I'll just play the chorus of this.
What's it called?
It's called "What Are You Going to Do to Help the Boys?"
Okay.
Now I don't have the sheet music to this, but I do have it on a 78 RPM record. You know, your patriotic songs, sometimes they were funny. This would be something that would you might even march to, because it's got that, you know, like, how are your levels? Here we go.
There you go.
Here's the chorus. What are you going to do for Uncle Sammy? What are you going to do to help the boys? If you mean to stay at home while they're fighting or the phone, the least that you can do is buy a Liberty Bond or two. If you're going to be a sympathetic miser, the kind that only lends a lot of noise, you're no better than the ones who love the Kaiser. Oh, what are you going to do to help the boys?
So, and that's something, it's a simple melody,
yeah,
and the lyrics are simple. Anybody can sing that. You don't have to be a professional singer.
Yeah.
Well, now here we are 100 years later, after the First World War. Do any of these songs, these popular songs from that era, do they still live on well in popular culture, or have we put them behind us?
Well, I think we probably put them behind us because, you know, they were in the context of the war.
That's musician Dale Evans, who is teaming up with singer-songwriter Hannah Kerrigan for a program entitled Music from the Great War, Saturday at 1 p.m. at the McLean County Museum of History in Bloomington. Admission is free. I'm Laura Kennedy.
Here's one of the more lighthearted and risque songs to come out of Tin Pan Alley during World War I. Dale Evans sings If He Can Fight Like He Can Love, Goodnight Germany by George W. Meyer, Grant Clark, and Howard Rogers. The song was a hit for the Farber sisters in 1918.
Like he can love, oh, what a soldier boy he'll be. If he's just half as good in a trench as he was in the park on a bench, then every Hun had better run.
At our website, WGLT.org, you can find individual stories and interviews heard on Sound Ideas, or look for the full episode podcast with help today from Laura Kennedy and Ryan Denham. Share your thoughts about the show at facebook.com/WGLTFM. Email us at news@WGLT.org or tweet. Use the hashtag Sound Ideas. We're all at WGLT News. This is WGLT Normal.
Why then it's good night, Germany.